And welcome everybody to the draft report webinar on coastal flood risk management strategies and measures for the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study. My name is Lauren Lake. I work for the Army Corps of Engineers Institute for Water Resources, and I will be today's facilitator, assisted by our AT&T technology moderator, Colin. We are happy to have the following speakers on the phone to go over some topics presented in the report. These are all members of the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study team, and they will be taking turns to share information and will be available for questions following the formal presentation. First, I would like to introduce, we have Dave Robbins, who is with the Corps' Baltimore District. He is the project manager for the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study. We have J.B. Smith from the Corps' Philadelphia District, who is the plan formulation lead for the study. Matthew Schrader from the Corps' Jacksonville District, a member of our of the study's engineering team. And Dr. Kelly Burks-Cope from our Engineering Research and Development Center, who is a member of our Natural and Nature-Based Features team. So again, as I mentioned before, we will have formal presentations by these speakers, and then following those presentations, we'll have a question and answer session. But throughout the presentations, feel free to chat in any questions you have as presenters are covering the material. And please be sure to include the name of the person that you would like to direct your questions into. And now I'd like to turn it over to Dave Robbins, the project manager for the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study, to get us started. Dave?
Thank you, Lauren. Thank you, Colin. And thanks all for joining today. Again, we are continuing our discussion and dialogue with our interagency stakeholders as part of the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study. You're participating today because you've been involved in previous coordination and previous webinars, and we wanted to take the opportunity to get a little bit in some of the details associated with the Comprehensive Study, specifically for today related to our measures that were considered and strategies and measures that were considered as part of the development of the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study framework. So the next few slides that you'll see on the webinar here is general information that we've covered previously. I'll try to be brief as we go forward here. So the background, again, Hurricane Sandy occurred back in 2012 and was a broad event that caused extensive damages across primarily the northeast coast from New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, and which prompted Congress to pass the Public Law 13-2, the Disaster Relief Appropriations Act. Next slide. With that Appropriations Act, that also included the authorization for the comprehensive study, which allowed for $20 million to be available by the Corps of Engineers to conduct a comprehensive study to address the flood risk from vulnerable coastal populations. The primary goals of the framework today, of the framework and the comprehensive study are to provide a risk reduction framework consistent with the Corps of Engineers and NOAA rebuilding principles that were developed following the Sandy event. The other goal is to support the resilient coastal communities, again, looking forward for future planning efforts to develop a sustainable coastal landscape, including the consideration for future sea level rise and climate change, and again, the ultimate goal to reduce risk to vulnerable population, property, ecosystems, and infrastructure. Next slide is just an overview again of who is working on the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study. The team is comprised of USAIDS, of Corps of Engineers experts from across the North Atlantic Division, the Institute for Water Resources, and also our ERDC lab. And from there, we have experts from the engineering field, economics, environmental, cultural resources, and social characteristics, sea level change and climate change experts, plan formulation, and GIS experts. Again, the primary products to be developed as part of the comprehensive study is the coastal framework. The framework is a regional, would be completed and considered a regional scale product which was developed in a collaborative nature across the 10 states and our federal and state stakeholders. The framework will present opportunities for coastal risk reduction by region and state, and by doing so, identify a range of potential solutions and parametric costs. We'll also look to identify opportunities warranting additional analysis and identify opportunities for to address social and institutional barriers. This is not a decision document. We are not conducting NEPA, and there won't be any site-specific recommendations for projects as a result of the framework. So with that, I'll pass it off to Jay to get into some of the discussion here today related to coastal flow risk management strategies and management measures.
All right. Thank you, Dave. Before we discuss individual flood risk management measures, I'd like to offer a bigger picture look at some overarching strategies which were used to develop those flood risk management measures. We developed three strategies, and those were explored as shown on the slide here: active risk management, acclimation, and retreat. Again, these were used as a big picture look of what measures could be identified as part of the comprehensive study. Active risk management are strategies which offer protection, flood risk management protection, for the here and now, for the present. This includes structural and nature-based features. Acclimation or adaptation are features, measures which could offer resilience going forward associated with sea level rise and climate change. And those include our natural and nature-based features, which are features that mimic natural features, and non-structural. The third strategy we employed was retreat, including things such as floodplain management, acquisitions, rolling easements. And I know retreat and acquisition is a tough thing to swallow for communities and governmental agencies, but we thought that to look at the big picture in terms of providing resilience for our coastlines, that retreat and the policy and programmatic implications of that should be covered and is covered in the comprehensive study. If you could turn to the next slide, the flood risk management measures were developed based upon those strategies, and we've done a lot of work in developing those, a lot of input from stakeholders. As you can see on the screen here, we have the coastal risk reduction resilience measure summary, fondly known as the Green Paper, which is a great avenue and opportunity for folks to review exactly the specific measures. And then we also held a number of workshops, the most important of which is a workshop in Hoboken in June of 2013 to look at different measure scenarios and get the input of many stakeholders. Basically, in summary, there are three different types of measures that I'd like to ask the next speaker, Matt Schrader, to present in more detail. Those include structural, which, again, are engineered structures, as well as NNBF, natural and nature-based features, non-structural, flood-proofing, elevation, acquisition, and also policy and programmatic measures, which includes floodplain management, land use planning, policies, program, and such. So I'd like to turn the microphone over to Matt Schrader, who could then discuss a little more information on structural measures.
All right. Thanks, JB. I'm going to go over some of the structural measures. I'm not going to cover nature and nature-based features, even though those fall under structural. Kelly's going to talk about those in a little bit. But the table on the screen now in the left-hand column shows the structural categories that I'll be covering. The column just to the right of that shows that some of these categories have specific measures in them. So, for instance, beach nourishment or beach restoration has beach fill, dunes, and barrier island restoration incorporated underneath it. What the last column show are the typical storm tide and wave design values for each of these measures. So, for example, storm surge barriers, which are the first row, are typically designed for the 0.2% flood. And the design and wave level values presented in these tables are considered reasonable and representative of the entire study area of the risk reduction that could be provided at the NACCS study area scale, not necessarily for specific project-specific scales. So these annual performance values determine what extent the vulnerability can be reduced. For example, application of a flood wall which has a 1% annual chance of the design being exceeded. If you were to build that within a vulnerable area, it would result in a reduction in the probability of flooding from some existing value to a 1% chance in any given year. So the main takeaway from this table is the higher the level of risk reduction associated with the measure, the larger the reduction in flooding probability and vulnerability. All right, next slide, please. So the study also developed conceptual designs for structural measures. And what this table shows are the water levels used for those designs. The main takeaway here is that generally structural measures such as beach restoration, levees, et cetera, were assumed to be designed to the 1% flood elevation plus a 3-foot allowance to account for future sea level rise. Only the storm surge barriers were designed to a higher 0.2% plus 3-foot elevation water level. And this additional 3-foot allowance, this is to account for future sea level rise, and it's consistent with the Corps' and NOAA's intermediate scenario for projected sea level rise by the year 2118. Next slide, please. All right, I just wanted to put a few pictures up here of some of the structural measures that people may not be too familiar with. The first photo on this slide on the left is a storm surge barrier, and these barriers are typically constructed at tidal inlets and reduce risk to estuaries against storm surge flooding and waves basically coming in through the inlet. In most cases, the barrier consists of a series of movable gates, and that's what's shown in this picture. They normally stay open under normal conditions to let boats and water flow through, but during times of expected surge, they can close those gates to protect the area or the estuary behind it. So the second photo to the right are breakwaters used in combination with beach restoration. Breakwaters are typically built of rock as rubble mound structures. And this image shows a field of detached breakwaters constructed in combination with beach nourishment to protect coastal development. I think probably a lot of people know what breakwaters are, but this is a good image of an actual field of breakwaters. Breakwaters can also have other applications, such as being constructed near the mouths of harbors to shelter the harbor from wave action. Next slide, please. So on this slide, the image on the left is a rapid deployment flood wall, and these structures are temporarily erected along the banks of a river or estuary or in the path of floodwaters to prevent water from reaching the area behind the structure. As the name implies, they're temporary. After the storm or flood, the structures can be removed. This category also includes permanently installed deployable flood barriers. But the point of these is that they actually rise into position during flooding. They're not always up. They actually fall flat or sink and rise into position when necessary. The next image on the right is a permanent flood wall, and probably a lot of people are familiar with this, but the point here is that they're basically similar to seawalls, usually constructed from concrete or sheet pile. But these structures are used to protect relatively small areas or areas with limited space for flood protection, maybe someplace where you couldn't build a levee or some wide earthen structure like that. And they're typically used to fight against lower levels of flooding. So with that, I'm going to pass the presentation back over to Dave.
Okay, great. Thanks, Matt. So the next slide here is focused on non-structural and policy and programmatic options. The non-structural measures category, which includes the building retrofits, acquisition, and evacuation, and also flood warning systems, again, are an opportunity to focus on being able to acclimate to changing water surface elevations over the course of the future. Basically, all the various floodproofing, elevating of structures, relocating of structures, et cetera, can be something that could be considered adaptable over time, if you will. For example, some of the structural designs that Matt referenced are based on stationarity, where we understand that there's some level of design to construct a structural feature. However, typically a lot of the hard structural features are fixed in place and oftentimes may not offer a level of adaptability over time. For example, a flood wall, you would have to elevate that structure, which would take an extensive engineering work to do that. However, for flood proofing, perhaps there's an opportunity to address a level of protection for a water surface elevation and flood event, and then that could change over time. So as part of these three categories, the various measures that were considered and aggregated into those categories include flood proofing, wet and dry flood proofing, again, elevating of structures, relocating of structures and ring walls, and then acquisition and evacuation. Jay referenced the fact of retreat, of being able to acquire properties that are in the floodplain and convert to open space to avoid future flood damages, and then also enhance warning systems to better prepare and evacuate communities in the event of a looming hazard. Policy and programmatic measures are opportunities that could be applied across the study area landscape. These are opportunities that are oftentimes already in place. It could also be adaptable as well over time as a part of a policy decision and implementation, focusing on, for example, floodplain management. Local floodplain ordinances can be adjusted to go up and above the National Flood Insurance Program requirements for various communities within participating in the program. Land use planning, understanding where floodplains are and limiting development in those areas. State and municipal policies, again, at a broader scale, focusing on building codes, tax adjustments to, again, influence where development could occur, and again, avoid development in floodplains or areas of higher vulnerability. Natural resources, again, thinking about how natural features or even natural features could play a role as part of flood risk management, surface water management, taking into account the interface between stormwater and alluvial and estuarine environments, understanding the fact that there's not much knowledge at this point as far as the interaction between that interface and the need to consider that further, and also the increased awareness and education of folks living in and you know, people and businesses living in a floodplain. We've experienced the fact that some people are living in floodplain and they don't have flood insurance on their structures because they don't have a mortgage, for example. So being able to educate folks on the importance of floodplain awareness and other opportunities to address flood risk by being more knowledgeable of the surroundings. So with that, maybe we can pass it off to Kelly to talk a little bit more and focus on natural nature-based features as a flood risk opportunity.
Thanks, Dave. We've all been talking all along about these ideas of not only these structural solutions, but also natural and nature-based features that could be possibly blended with these solutions to reduce risks and to increase coastal resiliency. The idea here is that natural features, those features that are like created or evolve over time through the actions of physical or biological or geological and chemical processes, they're already out there operating in nature. We might be able to do things like restorations, rehabilitations, enhancements of those features already on the landscape. But we could also take a look at natural and or nature-based features, which are those that mimic the characteristics of the natural features that are created by human design, engineering, and the construction of these features that would then provide the risk reduction and possibly even other ecosystem goods and services that might be garnered from doing blended solutions. So on the next slide, I have an example of kind of a hypothetical what might be considered. If you click it once, you're going to see that a bulkhead might be placed in, and you would expect to see a series of benefits that would be garnered from doing a bulkhead solution versus a combination of bulkhead and maybe some emergent marsh out in front of that, the services or the benefits that might be offered by doing both would be greater than doing just the one. If you click again, the idea would be that you might think of another alternative, something that's further out into the off the shoreline a bit, maybe a submerged, like a artificial reef, and then some aquatic vegetation between it and the shoreline, and that would offer us a different suite of benefits that you accounted for. Alternatively, you could do the whole enchilada, and that's the last click on the slides, which would be what we're calling these blended solutions. The idea is doing structural and non-structural, these NMBF features, along with these other two opportunities. Some of these NMBF features might be sacrificial in nature. They reduce the risks of the event and are basically taken out with the storm and then replaced. So we do have to take into account operations and management of these and maintenance of these. But the idea is that we're not going to look at just single structural features. We're going to start looking at these blended solutions to see what they have to offer. In terms of the natural and nature-based features, we're looking at everything from islands, reefs, beaches, dunes, mudflats, and the submerged aquatic vegetation, salt marshes, those kinds of things that are right there coastal. But we're also looking further inland, up into the inland, to look at freshwater marshes, buffer zones, riparian buffer zones, for example, and then forests and shrublands. On the next slide, I think I'm passing it back to you, Dave.
Great. Thanks, Kelly. So the slide that you see here is shoreline applicability. So basically, as part of the comprehensive study, we understand the fact that in order to address flood risk to vulnerable coastal populations, there's a suite of strategies and management measures. So as part of the comp study, and you'll see in the various state appendices that where would be an opportunity to consider these types of measures to address flood risk. And so there's a way to relate these types of management measures and strategies and management measures to shoreline type. And so you'll see here that we use the NOAA ESI data that we obtained and we have for the entire study area to identify various categories of shoreline. And then from there, which measures will be applicable for those types of shorelines. And so as a way to perhaps identify, you know, where are those areas at risk, what can you do about it? Well, here's a way to screen out based on the need that and the services that are interested in achieving as far as coastal storm risk management and resilience, what would be the appropriate strategy? For example, in an area of very high development where there's a lot of areas that where you want to focus on flood risk management to address people, property, and infrastructure, typically you would look for an opportunity or a measure that would offer a higher level of protection from a storm event, for example. And as Matt alluded to previously, in an area of an estuary, for example, with an inlet, there's an opportunity to consider a storm surge barrier that would be able to address a large event for a broader area within that area. In smaller areas along the coastline, smaller communities where it might be appropriate for perhaps a levee in one area, and then in areas of lesser development, maybe the natural nature-based haste or other opportunities would be appropriate. So basically thinking along those lines of what is along the coast that requires some level to address flood risk and what are the opportunities to do that. And Kelly alluded to the fact of blended solutions. Not only are we thinking about specific strategies or measures, but in the framework we want to present the fact that taking all of these measures together actually offers a stronger case for flood risk management and increasing resilience. For example, in an area that along the coastline, for example, Barrier Island, where there is an opportunity for a dune if it's not already in place, there you can implement some level of non-structural measures behind that dune to increase resilience and reduce for those types of storms that where could potentially in the future see a higher magnitude event occur, which would overtop that dune, there would still be an opportunity to address damages behind it. So if there's a dune in place, there will be an opportunity to elevate structures so that the sensitivity of that area to the flood hazard would be reduced. Similarly, there could be opportunities for a strategy to think as part of those types of features that can be resilient, that could be incorporated into communities and flood risk management, focusing on critical infrastructure and those types of features that would increase resilience. As we saw as part of Hurricane Sandy, the area in the Northeast was affected greatly by the second and third effects in the lines of causation from the impact, the direct impacts of the storm event. For example, knocking out a refinery where gas stations weren't able to get gas, and then gas couldn't get to the people to fuel their generators. So if there's a way to focus on that refinery to be sure that that's an opportunity to protect or an opportunity for some level of risk management, that could address and increase the resiliency of the time that the community could bounce back from that storm event. So we want to think about these ideas not only from what's initially out there that you can screen as far as a management measure based on shoreline type, what are those opportunities there to combine these solutions into a blended array of flood risk management, into a flood risk management system. And again, another component of this, and as part of the comprehensive study, when you want to think about long-term planning as well, those potential impacts from sea level rise and climate change. There's been a lot of interest in sea level change and the potential impacts that could occur, one of which is the fact that there would be potential inundation just from sea level rise alone. We addressed that, or at least identify that in the comprehensive study. But then another component to that is with sea level rise and a future storm event, the level of protection currently offered by some level of risk management would essentially be reduced by the extreme water event that would occur in the future. So we want to be sure to think about, in from a long-term perspective, what are these types of blended solutions that would offer communities that they need to start thinking about to address those long-term vulnerabilities, to address the short-term vulnerabilities, and what to do about the existing flood risk at this point in time. So that's where we wanted to, again, we talk about the strategies. What would be the appropriate strategy to consider? Active risk management. If it's an area that there's likely an area of high development, that would be likely to consider some level of active risk management to address flood risk. And those areas that could acclimate to the flood hazard, barrier islands that are there, and estuaries that are susceptible to future impacts of sea level rise, are there opportunity to acclimate to future flood hazards, thinking about long-term prospects and vulnerabilities in the short term. And then obviously the retreat component. Is it appropriate to start thinking about retreating as a solution to address flood risk? So again, we want to think about those strategies. Under those strategies, we think about aggregate measures and then their applicability to various communities across the study area, and then ultimately thinking about combining it all together as a blended solution to address flood risk and increase resiliency. So that essentially concludes the presentation today. We just want to touch on what happens next. At this point in time, the draft analyses are available for review and comment. Again, we're focusing on the opportunity to receive comments and further complete the activities that the team is currently ongoing. We'll wrap that up by the end of this month. The team will then integrate the various components together and develop a draft report by the end of May and leading into report production through June, ultimately leading into our vertical team review and other internal reviews over the summer in order to submit a final report to Congress by January 2015. For review information, a lot of the folks on this webinar today should have received an email to receive these draft analyses, which includes the various topics that we were discussing today. There's information on this slide. You should have received a automated email to access an electronic version of the file. There should be a link to provide a feedback with some guiding questions to keep in mind during review. And again, following from these webinars is another opportunity to interact and have dialogue with the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study team on various topics. At this point in time, we're looking for all feedback on the draft analyses by April 14th, which is in a couple weeks. What happens next? Again, following up on where we are with the technical challenges, please contact me. We'll work with you to be sure that you have an opportunity to access the document. If you have any other general issues or further coordination, we can connect the dots if you need to reach out to someone on the study team for more information. My contact information is here on the slide. With that, I'll pass it back to Lauren.
Great. Thanks, Dave, and thank you to all our presenters. I wanted to first note that the slides from today's webinar, as well as our other webinars that we have already concluded, are available on the Comprehensive Study website, which is www.nad.usace.army.mil/compstudy. And so now we will move into our question and answer period. We have had a few questions submitted during the webinar, and so we'll go to those first. But I do want to remind folks that they can chat in any questions you have using your chat function in the webinar. Please be sure to address those questions to all presenters. And then you can also raise your hand, and we will transfer the mic over to you when it's time to do those questions. So first, Tim Dillingham says, can you clarify the risk reduction measure by referencing to a more common nomenclature such as 100-year storm? This would give us a way to compare efficacy risk reduction to what was experienced. And Dave, I'm not sure if you want to comment on that at all, or Matthew or Jay.
Sure. Thanks, Lauren. I'll take a crack, Matt, and then maybe you can help me. But basically, as far as the nomenclature for the storm event, as far as the risk reduction nomenclature aligning with the 100-year storm event, the Corps of Engineers has guidance to reference exceedance probabilities, so you may see that. But as far as aligning to specific storm events, the storm events as part of a coastal storm vary depending on where the landfall occurs, speed of storm, and et cetera. So, for example, Hurricane Sandy, it's my understanding that Ocean City, Maryland experienced about a 20-year event, whereas New York City may have been over a 200-year event. So the probabilities change based on the location of the storm and other characteristics of the actual storm. So we wanted to, again, as part of the comp study, focus on those types of level of protection, I guess, if you will, to what would be appropriate or people are interested in understanding related to flood insurance and other known ways of understanding flood risk. But as far as 100-year storm, we need to focus on exceedance probabilities. Matt, is there anything to add?
Yeah, I would just add that there was a lot of discussion about that, and it came down to the fact that just stating the 100-year storm can tend to be a little bit confusing for the public. A lot of times it's perceived that if you had the 100-year storm last week, then you're not going to have another such storm for another 100 years, and that's not the case. It really comes down to the exceedance probability of the storm, and it was really to try and avoid misunderstanding by the public as well. That was another big factor for going with those probabilities instead.
Okay, great. Thank you, Dave and Matt. Dave, also, there's another question from Daniel Otis. How does the Army Corps study relate to the draft Federal Flood Risk Management Standard currently undergoing multi-agency review? The proposed standard would apply nationwide in both coastal and riverine settings. There is concern that the NAC study and the Federal Flood Risk Management Standard may be divergent.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Lauren. Thanks, Daniel. It's my understanding that headquarters is and others are focusing on the from a national perspective related to the flood risk management. We've had some coordination with those folks for the national flood risk management and how those related to how the budgeting process is focused on flood risk management. So that's the type of coordination that we've been having here. I don't know if I don't have the details to really get into to really address this question at this time. Perhaps someone else on the phone may.
Dave, actually, I can also address it. I know that the flood risk management standard is also part of it will be focused on Executive Order 11988, which obviously as a federal agency, the Corps is underneath. And so so working through that guidance, we will be under this new standard as well. So I would say that the comprehensive study proposes some strategies and measures that can be utilized by different agencies along the coastline, but that we all have to work within our guidance that currently exists and will be forthcoming. So that's also another way that we will be coordinating that through those headquarters folks that are working to develop the standard. Okay. We have another question from Matthew Wall. Can you provide a brief discussion or information on how natural-based measures for flood risk reduction can impact the National Flood Insurance Program flood map and or flood insurance costs? Investments in reduction of flood risk are going to continue to be based on return on investment as well as political viability. Political viability for the use of public funding could be improved if it showed that the positive impact reduces flood insurance for every day, every year costs, as well as protecting things from storm events. And Dave or Kelly or Jay, would you be able to respond to this question?
Dave, you want to take a stab and then I'll help?
Sure. Thanks, Kelly. That's why we wanted to identify a range of the annual probabilities being exceeded for the various measures. There could be an opportunity as part of a flood risk management system which incorporates natural nature-based features to achieve what could be, once you take into account risk and uncertainty, addressing flood risk to the 1% annual chance. And then accordingly affect the National Flood Insurance rate map and show it as not requiring flood insurance behind it. So that there's an opportunity to incorporate into a system. But as far as the 1% annual chance flood for which flood insurance is based, there would be an opportunity to do that if you can show with risk uncertainty that there is a way to address the flood to that water surface elevation at that point in time for that. Anything to add, Kelly?
No, I think you touched on it. I think the point here is that they are going to be, these blended solutions are going to be subjected to the same level of scrutiny and the same level of evidence must be used to assess whether they're viable or not. And the presentation of that will be very transparent and that the political viability then could be captured.
Okay, great. Thank you, Dave and Kelly. We have a couple of comments from Hans Morris. The first comment is, increased public awareness. This is a critical measure that should be emphasized as number one. Without objective informed public awareness, implementation of policy and public investment is problematic. Number two, managed phased retreat. This does not appear to be emphasized as a long-term strategy. This intergenerational measure should be considered to address areas that become continually vulnerable to evolving environmental effects. Dave, Jay, do you have any comments on those comments?
Sure. Thanks for your comment, Mr. Moritz. In terms of public awareness, it's definitely something that we're considering, not necessarily as we develop the draft analyses for Congress in January 2015, but as we implement the policy and programmatic measures, public awareness absolutely is a priority. And in terms of managed phase retreat, that is considered as part of our policy programmatic measures. And absolutely, as sea level rises and there are more environmental effects, the long-term consideration of retreat and managed retreat will be considered as part of the comprehensive study. So thanks for your comments.
Great. Thank you, Jay. Carolyn Kern has a question, and I believe I'll direct this to Kelly and Dave. Some of the blended combinations illustrated, for example, marsh and bulkhead, SAV, and breakwaters, are incompatible in many areas due to wave reflection from bulkheads or silting in behind breakwaters. How do you plan on providing site-specific guidance for these blended approaches in particular? And is there a difference between living shorelines and the blended approach?
So, Dave, I'll start, and you can help. How's that? the one thing to be aware of is that the study to date is the reconnaissance level, and it is not site-specific yet. So what you're seeing on the slides is hypothetical. It's an idea about what you might combine to get kind of a perspective for system-wide blending. Obviously, when we get down to the on-the-ground activities, we're going to go through plan formulation, and we're going to take into account the physical situation. The actual questions that you brought up are all taken into account when you start formulating plans. And some, obviously, as you point out, some of these blended solutions are not viable, and those will fall out. And so we will take kind of the site-specific approach as we do so and start doing those plans. JB can even talk to this. There will be guidance on how these will need to be put in place. Last but not least, there is a difference between living shorelines and these blended approaches. Living shorelines have a very distinct definition. There's actually websites out there with guidance on how to implement them, are often established on the basis or on the idea that you're trying to reduce erosion, for example. And the blended approach is a much broader scale, wider, more systematic look at what the coastal resiliency is going to be determined by. And we're looking at more than just living shorelines. The natural and nature-based features include things like islands and artificial reefs, but then combined with more what you might call gray structures or structural features that are necessary to be able to establish and control some of these or reduce some of these risks. Dave, did I do it?
Sounds good. Thanks, Kelly.
Okay.
All right, great. Thank you, Kelly. And Dave, I believe this next question is for you. As a result of the comprehensive study, will there be some broad combined measure recommendations at the regional and possibly local levels that will be developed? And would that involve possibly upgrading or canceling some of the current or currently planned projects in the North Atlantic area?
Great, very good question. Thank you. And again, from the framework perspective, and this kind of ties into the previous question and comment and response that Kelly provided. Again, the framework that we're developing here is really much constrained by the scale which we're working, the time frame to do it. Our study area is very, very broad, and so we really needed to take a very higher level look at this. And so one way that we wanted to address this was break it down by various scales. We consider the framework at a more regional type scale with our state dependencies capturing that information. We describe the fact that there should be a second tier analysis, and we get into a little bit of detail on how to do that in some of the state's dependencies. And then the third component, which the third tier would be a more site-specific type evaluation that won't be completed as part of the comprehensive study. And that's the type of work that Kelly alluded to address the previous comment about, those site-specific conditions and other constraints on which measures would apply at those in those areas. But as far as regional recommendations, again, we're not going to have any recommended plans. We are, as part of the comprehensive study, there are two interim reports that were developed following the enactment of filing the authorization to complete the study. One was to identify the existing projects, the core projects that are out there, as well as to identify opportunities for projects that are authorized but unconstructed. And so those projects are identified and already authorized and can be constructed as part of the supplemental funding. There are considerations for and on a separate but parallel path to reevaluate those studies individually and on an individual basis for various reasons. And so those types of projects are completed as part of the Corps of Engineers program separately, but being informed by some of the work that's going into the comprehensive study.
All right, thank you, Dave. Charles Shorten, apologize for mispronouncing your name, asked, how do you gauge the performance of an integrated and demountable demountable and permanent flood wall similar to Corps of Engineers designs in Cedar Rapids, Iowa? And I believe I'll address this question to Matt.
Yeah, I'll take a shot, and Dave, you can step in and correct me if you think you need to. But as Dave alluded to, we're not looking at project-specific recommendations under this phase of the study. The demountable flood wall would be similar to that rapid deployed or temporary flood wall that I talked about. So I think that this is kind of saying, have we gauged the performance differences for a project-specific area? And my answer would be no. That's something that will tier off of this study where they'll be looking at project-specific areas and then gauging, hey, in this particular area, does a temporary flood wall work better than a permanent flood wall or so forth? Dave, anything to add to that?
No, that sounds good. That's a good response there. And I guess the only thing to add would be as the meeting that JB referred to early on during the presentation in Hoboken, New Jersey, the measures meeting where we invited folks to think about flood risk management measures and innovative opportunities to address flood risk increased resilience. We did consider a whole list of measures that are out there from the input that we received. We aggregated that into the various categories of measures. So basically any deviation from those overall features would be captured by that aggregated category of a measure. But again, as Matt mentioned, those specific variations at a site-specific location would have to be considered as part of a subsequent effort at a more manageable and at a smaller scale.
Thank you, Matt and Dave. Peter Murdoch, I asked about the slides, if they will be available on the web for review and further discussion. And again, yes, the slides from today's webinar as well as previous webinars are available on the COMP study website. Matthew Wall asks, will the final report include thoughts about the correction of activities that have occurred in the past that have increased flood risk? For example, the channelization of rivers that have negatively affected the capacity of deltas to reduce storm surge. Dave or Jay, would you like to address that?
Sure, Jay. I can start there. I think as part of correction of activities, I'm not sure if we're looking to correct anything. We did characterize existing projects that are out there in as far as the existing conditions characterization, specifically core projects. We understand and know where our core projects are, and so as part of that, that's captured in our existing conditions of the coastal landscape. We also identify our post-Sandy landscape, which incorporates those existing conditions plus those other projects that are authorized but unconstructed. But as far as correcting any type of negative impacts from any types of projects, I think that would be considered as part of a subsequent effort that wouldn't be included as part of this effort.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that. I agree with Dave that we're not necessarily correcting anything. The only thing that we might be doing is enhancing existing projects, such as in the Barrier Island where there's an existing beach fill that may or may not have a dune. We might recommend or offer as strategy opportunities the addition of a dune in that case. But correction, I would say we're not doing that.
Oh, great. Thank you both. Jerry Galloway asks, the 1% standard most frequently discussed is in reality a flood insurance rate standard. The Corps has long supported a higher standard for urban areas. The 2006 National Flood Insurance Program evaluation indicated that 1% was an inadequate flood management standard, and the Chief of Engineers has been on record that the New Orleans 1% levees are a stop on the road to higher levels. California has legislated that new Central Valley levees protecting urban areas must have a minimum of 200-year protection. How did 1% become a standard for coastal? And Dave or Jay, would you want to take a stab at replying to that one?
Sure, I'll take a stab. Yes, thanks for the comment. It's a good comment there in question, Ms. Galloway. So the 1%, again, was across this broad study area was selected for considering what would be a conceptual design for the various management measures because of all the various ordinances that are connected to the municipalities and states participating in the flood insurance program. Flood insurance is definitely a very big issue in the coastal region, but what we do want to do, and one thing that we want to really characterized as part of the comprehensive study is the residual risk, and that is how we wanted to address that issue as part of the comprehensive study is, and again, using data that's available across the entire study area, we captured the National Hurricane Program SLOSH data to identify inundation mapping from Category 1 through 4 storm event maximum storm events. And so that's what we wanted to characterize as a high magnitude, low probability event to identify those areas that would be at risk. However, those types of a measure that would be able to address the flood risk associated with that event it would be an issue to justify at this point as far as a cost. It would be a very very comprehensive structure to be able to address flood risk to that event. So we want, again, to align with what folks are doing with related to their ordinances, to floodplain, flood insurance, but identify the fact that in these areas, particularly in these areas of urban areas where these projects could be overtopped or, that a 1% level could be overtopped or could be exceeded, that those areas are still susceptible to inundation from a larger magnitude event. The other thing I wanted to mention is that, again, yes, the Corps of Engineers doesn't design projects to a specific standard. I think we touched on that earlier from previous comment. Currently, the Corps of Engineers policy is to optimize a project to establish net excess benefits. That is, identify a solution that would maximize the damages prevented for the least cost. And so our projects that are currently authorized and constructed are optimized projects and not designed to a specific level of protection. Anyone else add that, Jay or Matt?
No, it's very well said.
We have nothing to add.
Great. Thank you, Dave. I'd like to pause now to see if we have any questions on the line. Also, again, please feel free to submit any additional questions. And do any of our presenters have questions that were submitted just to them that they would like to answer?
This is Matt Schrader. I do have one.
Okay.
This is from Doug Pietkowski, and he asked, could you please provide some insight as to the level of effort undertaken to identify, quantify available borrow area resources to support the beach/dune measures? And, again, I'll rely on Dave to fill in info if I missed something, but going back to we're not recommending project-specific measures in this study. So while we've done conceptual designs for beach nourishment or beach nourishment with dunes and given a parametric cost for how much a typical beach nourishment would cost for, you know, taking into account the whole study area, we've given a cost per linear foot, we haven't gone in and said, all right, you're going to need to build, you know, 2 miles of beach nourishment here and 1 mile of beach nourishment here, and said overall we're going to need 30 million cubic yards of sand. We haven't gotten to that level. Those will be follow-on studies as a result of this study. So to my knowledge, and I just joined the study team about a month ago, but they're not going out there and taking core borings or doing any geotech investigations to actually look for the sand. But those will all be things that follow on after the study. Anything to add, Dave?
Yeah, thanks, man. That's good script. And also, the fact is that the information that's being generated as part of this comprehensive study is again, we want to make it available to not just the core, but other stakeholders. And again, the information that we're presenting here in the framework to evaluate risk and the opportunity to address risk by various management strategies and management measures. And again, the thought that the scale which we were working, we were able to generally identify those areas of risk and what we vulnerable, which would align with what would be a general strategy that a more specific evaluation would consider. And we have to identify the process of getting into, the additional information needed to, again, better inform at a smaller scale what will be risk, exposure, and vulnerability, and then what will be done about it as part of that third tier of investigation. But the framework, again, is to be able to generally stream some of this information out to allow state and local folks as well as NGOs and others to be able to use, okay, so I'm in the X area along the shoreline and I have some level of inundation. I understand that I have a large population of resident that currently doesn't have a project or some level of risk reduction measure in place. What would be the appropriate consideration based on my shoreline type or other features that I know of that can pull from the comprehensive study, and then the various management measures we have, a general parametric unit cost estimate, unit cost that one could generate some level of a level of cost, because obviously cost is a very big driver of what strategy and what management measures would be considered going forward. So again, teeing up the fact that taking into account long-term planning, what's of it to address, to understand long-term vulnerabilities, address the existing vulnerabilities, and allowing it and presenting information that one can use to think about it and take the next steps, not just for the core, but for everyone else within the study area.
David, I'd also like to mention that the Department of Interior Bureau of Ocean Energy and Minerals, I believe, BOEM, just received a lot of sandy funding to identify appropriate sand sources associated with the sandy legislation. So that, that's not something that the Corps needs to get involved in, but we're working with our partners such as BOEM to do just that.
Great. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you all. I do have one additional comment from Daniel Otis. He says it might be worth mentioning that the draft Federal Flood Risk Management Standard proposes a 100-year flood plus 7 feet standard. And also, again, want to pause and see if anybody else has questions. Either our presenters have questions that have been submitted solely to them, or if any of our participants want to submit a question to all presenters. Okay. Well, barring no further questions, we would like to thank all our participants for calling into today's webinar, and thank you to all our speakers who presented today and answered questions, and appreciate the great questions and information and discussion on today's webinar. With that, this concludes our webinar. Thank you again.